It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Going to start off with President Biden's speech. My fellow Americans, the war in Afghanistan is now over. Over. Thank goodness. 20 years, now over. And about time. Someone finally with the courage to go, you know what, we're getting out. And look, didn't have much of a choice, to be honest. The former guy put him in this position. The former guy put the whole country in this position. Mr. Art of the Bad Deal. As Biden said, the real choice was between leaving and escalating. Between getting out or sending a lot more people in. Because as he pointed out, the Taliban was stronger than they had been since 2001. And all of that falls back on the former guy who, look, said he was getting out. Now, I do give him credit for moving us in that direction. We should have been out years ago. But finally, Joe Biden got us out. And he said, look, you know, the bottom line is 90% of Americans of Afghanistan who wanted to leave were able to leave. And for those remaining, he said, there is no deadline. We remain committed to getting them out if they want to come out. Now, look, you know, like we talked about the other night, there are going to be people who want to stay. There are going to be people who work for NGOs. There are going to be people who work for all kinds of different entities or are married to people. Who knows what their reasons, what their rationales, what their thoughts are. They're going to voluntarily choose to stay. That's their choice. But here's the thing. We're out of it. Now, the right-wing rage machine was in overdrive today. You had Lauren Boebert. You had Madison Cawthorn. You had the whole traitor caucus calling for Biden to resign or they're going to impeach him. Not just him, not just Biden, but Vice President Harris and Secretary Blinken and Pelosi, too. No, they're going to go, they're going to sweep everything. Understand, this is their election strategy in 2022. This is all they have because there's no policy there. There's no moving the country forward. There's nothing there other than rage, fear and smear, and more rage. Don't eat the outrage candy. Stop. Now, I do find it interesting and I find it adorable. I do find it adorable that the rageaholic followers chimed right in of the traitor caucus and these right-wing grifters and snake oil salesmen. But it didn't just stop at, you know, Joe Biden, you know, what a mess. And it was Joe Biden hates dogs. And evidently I hate dogs too. So today I've been playing Chew Toy for the keyboard cowboys who they've got really nothing better to do but sit in their PJs and type away. Oh, so adorable. And look, I'm glad I gave them something to do today. Maybe a kernel of thought popped into their head. I did have fun playing with the rage and grievance crowd on Twitter because Twitter is one of those weird places where it's mob mentality. So when the main grifter says, go get him, they all come with their witty lines, their bad grammar, their typos, their misused words. You know, the kind of stuff you'd expect from the rabid right wing of our political spectrum. But the thing that's really just bizarre is the people pushing the, you know, Biden left dogs in Afghanistan frame. They know what they're doing. They know the outrage candy. They know they can get these people all riled up and bunched up in the panties and fuming at the mouth so that they'll dig deep into their pockets and they'll donate. Because that's what the rage machine thrives on. Keeping people really amped up. Keeping them all twisted in the panties. And I got to be honest, you know, they're good at it. They're good at feeding the flock the red meat. They most certainly are. They get lots of practice, and they're good at it. I give them credit. They are fantastic at it. But these people, I'll tell you, these are absolutely adorable. The ones that are real people. Now, understand, there were a bunch of people, and I spent a couple minutes reading through some of the comments, and they're all the same. Personal attacks, you're this, you're that. Okay. You sat down and that's the best you could come up with? Is our education system failing you that badly that the best you could come up with is some nonsensical attack? And the answer is yes. But it's cute. It really is. Because I actually had the audacity to point out that no U.S. military dogs were left behind. For saying that, I am now a dog hater. Now, I did reach out to somebody who I trust, who is a military person, who assured me that no U.S. military dogs were left behind. His point was, we invest way too much money. They'll leave a broken down helicopter behind. They'll leave broken down disabled equipment behind. But those dogs, their handlers would not leave them under no circumstances. So anyone who's going to try, and this is what this person told me, anyone who's going to try and tell you that a soldier was going to leave his or her dog behind doesn't understand the relationship between the soldier and the dog. And this was one of those things, it was kind of the light bulb moment that made me go, this is all grift. This is all feeding the rage candy to the fuming class, because they need this. This is what they thrive on. They can't get through the day. And yet, you know who the real dog haters are? The former guy. The former guy hates not just dogs, but those losers and suckers in the military. Oddly enough, you didn't hear the rageaholics going on about that, because it's convenient to forget or to have never known. Ignorance is bliss, and it shows in the comments. And like I said, the video, they put out this video, and it's about 51 seconds of what is supposed to, I assume, be the Harman Karzai International Airport in Kabul. I'm supposed to believe that's what it is. And I can't say it is or it isn't. But there's four dogs that are walking through there, and the outrage machine is going, see, we left them behind. Nobody knows who those dogs belong to. Nobody knows who they are. But we do know that military contractors, we do know the military industrial complex, the profiteers, the mercenary class, they left them. They left them. And yet not one comment about the military-industrial complex, not one comment about the grifters and the thieves. And I guess Eric Prince didn't have enough seats on his $6,500 jet that only had a few takers, I guess. There was plenty of room for Eric Prince and Glenn Beck to have brought the dogs with them, but they didn't, because they need the outrage. They need the anger. And the thing that gets me is these people, the ones that are, again, that are real, because understand, most of the comments are from people who aren't real. Nobody sets up a Twitter account with George 6475-3897. Nobody does that, because you're never going to remember it. These are all fake accounts with fake comments, but it's made to make it look like, oh my gosh, the world's coming down and we're going to get you. And again, more feigned outrage, just like we saw with the birth of the Tea Party. This is the evil spawn of the Tea Party, and they know it. And the thing is I'm okay with them attacking me. I'm okay with it. But the sad thing is the people who are real, they're working people just like you and me. They're the people who have been lied to all these years. They're the people who need the Fox News. They need the OAN. They need the right-wing zealots and the grifters and the snake oil salesmen to get through their day and give them a sense of purpose. Because ultimately, they've got nothing left. And I sadly feel for them. Because here's the thing. And this is I couldn't help but think this all day today. As they're, throwing out their comments and how much they love the dogs. And I'm like, fine, throw some money in, send a jet, bring them back. and we'll send them to your house. What's interesting is nobody said, hey, what about those Afghani children? Nobody said, hey, what about the women that we're leaving behind? Nobody said anything about that. Nobody said anything about vetting the dogs. Oh, no. Oh, no. We have to go get the puppies. Screw the kids. Screw the mothers and the grandparents screw them. We're going to be out. We need outrage. And it's not even about the dogs. It's about the outrage. Now, here's the thing. I wish these folks would have had this level of outrage that they have at me today. I wish they'd have had that for the last 20 years. As the death tolls continued to climb, as the trillions of dollars were flowing out the door, and oh, by the way, our defense contractors were lining their pockets. In fact, I saw a story today that if you would have invested 10 grand in military industrial complex stocks at the beginning of this, that 10 grand would be 100 grand. 100 grand. So a lot of rich people got rich. And we know this. And if you don't, go and read Smedley Butler's War is a Racket, because it's the oldest racket. Get poor people to go off and die in a war that the rich people benefit from. And now we're watching the people who got us into this mess trying to frame the exit. The people who are responsible for getting us into this, the same lobbyists, the same talking heads, the same pundits, the same grifters, the same people who got us into this mess are the ones loading the gun and pointing it at each other, at each of us. So all these people who are, you know, they think they're protecting the dog. All they're doing is they're being used. They're the useful idiots, the dupes. The Jay Gould, I could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. And all you have to do is say, Joe Biden left four dogs behind. And we're going to start a hashtag, and we're going to start a money campaign so that the grifters can line their pockets. And at no point did we talk about the fact that over the last 20 years, we've lost 2,350 soldiers, another 21,000 people injured. Conservatively, the taxpayers spent over $45 billion a year. That's conservatively over $1 trillion over the entire span. I'm reading upwards of $3 trillion. Killed 31,000 civilians conservatively. Injured another nearly 30,000, conservative numbers. You know, in 2012, and this is one of those little factoids that sticks in my head, we had more soldiers commit suicide than there were killed in combat. I don't hear anyone outraged about that. It's, oh, Joe Biden left a dog behind. Joe Biden hates puppies. I mean, it really is the lowest and simplest attack possible. They hate puppies. Never mind the soldiers who have chronic multi-symptom illnesses. Never mind those. Never mind the people with Gulf War syndrome. Never mind those people. We care about the puppies. But Rick, the puppies. And again, we don't know whose puppies those were, but I'll tell you, I'll guarantee you. After my conversation with my friend in the military, there's no way that there was a U.S. service dog left. And there are stories out there that outside of the New York Post who nobody believes. And all of the right-wing, and I'm not going to call them news sources, all the propaganda sources. This could have been an opportunity to pull our country together, to say, we're going to now come home. We're going to now heal. We're going to now take care of all the people who over the last 20 years that we've left to linger, that we've left to suffer, that we've left to go it alone. We're going to now commit to taking the money that we were spending over there, making big rocks smaller, and we're going to take care of them. But you didn't hear that today. No, no. Because it's not about getting things done. It's not about progress. It's not about this country. It's about winning a Twitter. Oh, I got a Twitter comment. Oh. And it's adorable on a certain level. I mean, it's cute when you sit back and you realize it's all just ridiculous. And it's all political theater, and it's grift to make people think that, I can't say his name, pube sack is all I can come up with, that this guy somehow, he's their leader. Because he said, they don't want you to see this 51-second video that has no source cited. I don't even know when it was taken. I'm supposed to trust that that was even in Afghanistan? And the answer is no, because it's not about fact. It's not about getting information out. It's not even about holding the administration accountable. It's about tearing things down. It's about destruction. And the same thing we're seeing on school boards across this country, this is the right-wing MO. If they can't control it, they're going to destroy it. It's what they do. It's what fascists do. And every one of these people who are, oh no, we got, I have to question if they even know what they're fighting for. I would like to believe our education system was a little bit better and that critical thinking was a little bit better. Because my statement was very clear. There are no U.S. service dogs left behind. None. Now, what contractors do, what the likes of Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root and whomever else, it was Blackwater, now she's gone. They're running now flights. What these grifters do is they line their pockets. That's what they do really well. And the outrage machine, they get to keep us all knotted up and angry. So that we're willing to have an insurrection like we saw on January 6th. And we're willing to do that every week at school board meetings across this country because it's what they want. They want constant chaos. They want anarchy because they know the wealth class will make out. And ultimately, they will too. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
There's nothing more American than workers standing up. Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1864. That was the day the final battle of the Atlanta campaign began with the Battle of Jonesboro. The Union had been embroiled in a civil war with Confederate forces to end the slave labor system for 3.5 years. It had been a difficult summer. Battles were increasingly bloody, with casualties on both sides numbering into the tens of thousands. Criticisms intensified against key Union generals like Sherman and Grant. Pressure mounted against President Lincoln to end the war and withdraw the Emancipation Proclamation if necessary. General William T. Sherman mounted the Atlanta campaign earlier that year in May. His forces scored a number of victories throughout the summer, but could not decisively defeat Confederate forces. By August, Northern morale was so low that the Republican National Committee deemed Lincoln unelectable. The Democratic National Convention, convening in Chicago, had declared the war a failure and planned to ride to victory over Lincoln in the November elections. But Lincoln's commitment to emancipation was unwavering, and Sherman did not disappoint. He understood that Atlanta was, as historian Eric Foner describes it, a key railroad hub and the communications and transportation center for the entire Southeast. Sherman's forces had been marching down from Chattanooga for most of the summer. Finally, they marched to the south of Atlanta to cut the last key rail line. And on this day, Union forces positioned themselves at the Flint River and at the Macon and Western Railroad. Over the next 2 days, they would successfully beat back multiple Confederate assaults, destroying the rail line and forcing Confederate forces to abandon Atlanta. the city was now fully under union occupation.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news. You may remember me railing on the other day about the school board in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and how they were literally taking food out of the mouths of children by not re-upping for the federal program to help them feed all the kids in the school. My school district has it. A lot of school districts have taken the federal money to make sure that they can feed kids. This one said, no, we're not going to do it because they'll get lazy. They'll get dependent. finally, the outrage got to them and they changed their mind. Good thing. And this is where outrage is a good thing if used properly. Now, the craziness that we saw going on in the eastern part of the state in Pennsylvania, not good. When you got a guy who's saying, I'm literally going to go to a school board meeting with 20 guys and we're going to throw people out in the streets and install our people and get what we want. We going to have an insurrection every day? Is that the goal? Here to share some thoughts on that is Lamont McClure. Lamont is the Northampton County executive. The guy who said that was running against Lamont in this upcoming election. So I thought it'd be interesting to get his thoughts and his perspective. Lamont, thanks for taking time for us.
Good evening, Rick. Thank you so much for having me on your show tonight.
So I saw this video, and you can help me with this, because I only saw a clip of it. I saw this guy, Steve Lynch, basically losing his mind, saying that he was going to die on the anti-mask hill, and he was going to replace the school board, and he's going to do all this stuff. And I'm going, that seems a bit threatening.
Well, Rick, as you know, I am the incumbent county executive of Northampton County. Unlike most of Pennsylvania's 67 counties, we have a home rule charter, and I am the independently elected executive. Steve Lynch, the individual you're referencing, is the Republican nominee to take me on in the fall. Yes, you heard it. The Republicans nominated an actual domestic terrorist. And let me prove the point. He participated in the attempted coup in D.C. on January 6th. His participation was so serious that he admitted that the FBI came to his door and he cowered in his basement while they were at the door to interview him about his insurrectionist activities on January 6th. So that's the context for who this guy is. And you can go to my YouTube page or go to LamontMcClure.com. and see all about this insurrectionist. So when he threatened the school board with 20 strong men, and let's be clear, he said he was going to show up with 20 strong men and remove those people. He was going to give the school board an ultimatum. They leave or he was going to remove them. In my mind, that is the definition of domestic terrorism. Now, this guy is a QAnon conspiracy theorist. He shares all the QAnon conspiracy theories. He has called for the death, the execution of public officials on his Facebook page. This guy, he is not a legitimate candidate. He is a domestic terrorist who I believe should be investigated by the federal government for his insurrectionist activities.
No, but here's the thing, Lamont. In normal times, if I'm in your shoes, I want that kind of a kook. I want somebody who's, wearing the tinfoil hat, hiding in his basement from the FBI. But sadly, we're in this post-Trump era where that scene for some gets them excited and gets them motivated. And the outrage machine just keeps promoting and pushing them. Because look, after that comment, his numbers blew up. The crazy right, he's now their darling.
Well, but you hit it on the head. It is crazy. And we're fighting for democracy here. What he wants to get his hands on the election apparatus in Northampton County. And let me explain. Because, as I mentioned earlier, we're home rule. And because we're home rule, the elections division ultimately is the responsibility of the county executive. He and his right-wing zealots know that we are a bellwether county, not just in the Commonwealth, but across the nation. And if they can win Northampton County by hook or by crook, they can create a narrative that, for instance, how could Trump have possibly lost, which we know he did,
right?
How he could have possibly lost Northampton County. We cannot let a known insurrectionist, a domestic terrorist, become county executive because they want to get their hands on the election apparatus.
No, absolutely. And this is where these are people who do not believe in democracy. These are fascists. These are people who elections are only to confirm what they already believe. And if they don't get what the results they want, they're going to do what they saw on January 6th and what he had said he was going to do, to the school boards over a mask. And this is the part that gets me, Lamont. You know, we're talking about simply a cloth over someone's face to help protect them and others. Somehow for him, that's the hill that he is willing to die on. I'm sorry, I'm missing the point here.
Yeah, so it's entirely ideological, right? It's not about science or health for them. It's not about their freedom. It's all about politics. They've staked out this extreme position. And look, people who are unvaccinated are dying. They are dying. We need to get folks vaccinated. Vaccinations save lives and livelihoods. We need to protect each other by wearing our masks and staying distant when we can. I mean, these are common sense, science-based, data-based solutions to real problems. And guys like this don't care about people dying. They just want an ideological niche so that they can seize power. And we really have to prevent that. And people can help me preventing that by going to LamontMcClure.com. and donating. I have an Act Blue page. You can donate through PayPal, or you can send me an old-fashioned check through the snail mail. I mean, I know you didn't have me on here to
no,
talk
no.
The, about
look, this is part of the game. You got to raise money to because these folks, they're raising tons of money. The outrage machine is a money-making machine. This is what they do. So we've got to help folks like you move in their direction to get good, decent, honest people into these positions, because this guy has already told us what he believes in. He doesn't believe in democracy. He doesn't believe in the rule of law. And he sure as heck doesn't believe in keeping people safe, because it's my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that that event took place at Lehigh Valley, the hospital campus there, right?
No. I mean, he's had several rallies outside of hospital facilities throughout the county where he's calling for anti-vaccination policies. He's calling for anti-mask policies. Look, for this guy, for Lynch, freedom equals death. I don't understand it. I don't. I don't understand what the psychology is from where a person like that comes from. I believe in life. I want to be vaccinated. I want you to be vaccinated. Vaccinations save lives and livelihoods. These masks are going to keep little kids from getting sick. But for some reason, for Lynch, freedom equals death, and I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, ultimately, and I know a bunch of people like Lynch, that freedom means freedom for them and, well, the hell with you and me. And whatever they want is the rule, and, well, democracy be damned. So as you're talking to people, because obviously this is, this is an important campaign now, what are people saying about this? I mean, do you see him gaining traction in the Lehigh Valley? Do you see him, getting any support, really? I mean, I lived there for about 10 years. It wasn't crazy then. Has it gone crazy?
It's still not crazy. The Lehigh Valley is a wonderful place
yes.
to live and work and raise your children and to hope your children stay. They don't leave. I mean, economically, we're doing great. We're the third largest region in the state. We're the third largest economic region. We're really pressing Allegheny County and Southwest PA to be the second largest. We're really close. Things are great here. We have tremendous universities, Moravian College, Lehigh, Lafayette. We're just doing really great here. And it's a great place to work. Our populations are growing. We're thriving, but we do have a small minority of people like Lynch. And I think Lynch is sort of the worst of them. I can't understand what the Republican Party was thinking, not even putting up a candidate against him, because when you get one of the our two major parties' nominations, that does give you a little bit of a imprimatur of someone who should actually be in the race. But this guy's not a legitimate candidate. He is not fit to serve. And so we're very concerned about that. Lehigh Valley, great place to live and work. We're going to beat this guy, but I need folks, I need your listeners to go to LamontMcClure.com. We've got ActBlue, PayPal. Send us some money to help us defeat this guy because he truly is dangerous. He was at the insurrection. He participated in the attempted coup. The FBI came to interview him about it. He's threatened school boards with violence. He has called for the murder of elected officials on Facebook. He spreads QAnon conspiracy. This is a very dangerous man, and we must stop him and people like him right now.
No, I'm right there with you. But here's the weird thing. The death cult, formerly known as the GOP, their only goal is restraining and destroying government, tearing things down so that private interests can control things. At least that's my view on it. You don't have to agree. I'm looking at his website. I don't see a platform other than what is the ideological death cult platform of freedom and liberty. And they don't even define what they believe those are. So when you're talking to people, is issue now important? Does it matter what you believe in how you're going to do your job? Because, you know, I was checking out the work you've done. You've done some really good work as county commissioner. Does that even matter anymore?
No, it does matter. Like I said, the folks in Northampton County and the Lehigh Valley at large, they're good people, right? We've got great people here, including a lot of Republicans. A lot of Republicans are excellent folks, great folks, hardworking folks. Not going to hear me say a bad thing about Northampton County, regular old Republican voter folks. They're good people, too. But the bottom line is I haven't raised their taxes in 3 years. I'm not going to raise them this year. We might even be able to cut them. They like that. That's something they're talking about. You ask me what they're talking about. They're talking about the fact that I don't raise their taxes. They're talking about the fact that our administration has handled the coronavirus pandemic as well as they think could possibly be handled. We've done everything we could to crush the virus. We partnered with local hospitals to create testing sites. We've partnered with local hospitals to create vaccination sites. We have obtained as much or more PPE for first responders and frontline workers than just about any county in the Commonwealth. We have saved, by throwing a lifeline to over 1,000 small businesses, almost $25 million in grants to help them survive the COVID-19 pandemic and then help them thrive when we get on the other end of it. So these are just some of the things we've done over the 4 years, and people are talking about them and they do appreciate them. And it is a message that's resonating. But I also have to address the fact that Lynch is a domestic terrorist. I am running against a legitimate domestic terrorist. And don't let it fool you that he has the imprimatur of our other major party. This guy is not fit. He is not qualified. And we need to make sure that he is not elected because he's going to get a hold of that elections apparatus. And you don't want him to be in charge of that elections apparatus when the 2022 and 2024 elections come around because you don't know what he's capable of. A guy who'll go and start an attempted coup on January 6th, a guy who threatened to forcibly remove school directors, a guy who'll call for the murder of elected officials on Facebook. He's capable of anything when he's in charge of the election, and we must stop him. So go to LamontMcClure.com and make a donation, please.
I hope folks will go there, LamontMcClure.com. We'll get links out on social media and how you can take a look at this. So, you know, I just want to be crystal clear in this because, you know, there are people who say there isn't a big difference between Democrats and Republicans. This is one of those races where there couldn't be clearer differences. One person who seems to want to tear down the rule of law and democracy and overturn elections and do all that. And also, I would argue if he's in charge, the Lehigh Valley, Northampton County could be a COVID hotspot at some point, just at a time where we can't afford to have that happen.
Well, look, for Lynch, freedom equals death, and I don't understand it. But what I can tell you is you referenced elections. We put on fair, legal, and accurate elections in Northampton County, and we're very sensitive to the fact that we're a bellwether, not just for PA, but for the whole country. And we're only an hour and a half ride from the media capital of the world, New York City. So they pay attention to what this bellwether does, maybe even more than the bellwether that Erie is. So we're very sensitive that we have to get elections right. And as a matter of fact, we were the first to report in the Commonwealth our results in 2020. That was very important for us, not only to be fast, but accurate and efficient. And we put on legal, fair, and accurate elections. And as Steve Lynch has the apparatus of elections in Northampton County, they will not be fair, legal, and accurate. And that could have very dire consequences in 22 and especially 2024. Let me give you one example. Drop boxes. He won't have drop boxes. I had drop boxes. I had four, in one in each of our county council districts. There were over 10,000 votes cast in those drop boxes. Joe Biden only won Northampton County by about 2,000 votes. There won't be drop boxes in 2024, Steve. And that's just one, that's just one lawful way that he could interfere with people's right to vote. Imagine all the unlawful things Steve Lynch would get up to. And I'm not just this, I'm not casting aspersions. This was a guy who participated in the attempted coup. This is a guy who goes on Facebook and spreads QAnon conspiracy theories. You don't have to take my word for it. Go look at his Facebook page. It's insane. And we must defeat him. We must.
No, I've seen who he is, and I pair him in the same category as someone like Doug Mastriano. So as I'm looking at the state level, to have a county executive and the state senators that we've got wanting to do the same kind of Arizona-esque recounts here and all the shenanigans that we've seen across the country, it's dangerous to have people like this in elected office. And I keep coming back to, we got to vote for good people. We need good people to run for election, and we need voters who are going to be cognizant of the fact that we've got a traitor caucus now who wants to tear down our country. So last 30 seconds, this is usually where I go, you know, give me the 30-second elevator pitch, but don't vote for the terrorist is probably the best bumper sticker you could get.
Yeah, no, look, my opponent is a domestic terrorist, and that's what's on the line here. We must defeat him. We must keep his hands off the election apparatus. I would love to be sitting here. I know you're a labor guy. I would love to be sitting here talking to you about my recent labor council endorsement, about all the support I have from the building trades, all the support I have from AFSCME. I would love to be able to talk to you about all that, all the firefighter support that I have. I have a tremendous amount of labor support. I can't talk to you about any of that because I'm running against an actual traitor to our country.
Yeah. LamontMcClure.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. Lamont, thanks for coming on. I appreciate the time, and I hope you'll come back again and talk to us real soon.
Thanks, Rick. I appreciate it.
Good stuff. LamontMcClure.com. Go make a donation. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1921. That was the day the Battle of Blair Mountain raged in Logan County, West Virginia. Members of the United Mine Workers of America were attempting to organize the minefields in the southern part of the state. The efforts to bring workers to union was met with violent resistance. The miners armed themselves and marched south. As many as 10,000 miners joined the march. They met armed company men at Blair Mountain. In the battle that ensued, 1 million rounds were fired. The mine owners even hired private planes to drop bombs on Union miners. The U.S. Army intervened and the battle ended. Despite not being successful in their march, the bloody battle brought national attention to the violence in the coal fields. But that was not the last battle for Blair Mountain. In 2011, there was a proposal to bring mountaintop removal mining to Blair Mountain. This type of mining blasts off large chunks of a mountain surface to get at the coal seams below. Protesters stood against the proposal. They argued it would be environmentally devastating to the area. They also argued that it would blast away one of the most important sites of labor history in the nation. Some coal miners took exception to the protests.
In a CNN documentary on the conflict, one union miner said, quote, mountaintop removal is what built this house, sends that little girl to school, provides insurance for my wife. But another miner joined in the protest against removal. He told CNN that miners had been, quote, brainwashed to think, oh, I can't have a job unless it's a mountaintop removal job. In 2014, the state prohibited surface mining at Blair Mountain. For now, but that is subject to change. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, tragedy in Mississippi. Two people were killed and 10 others injured as a giant crater opened up, 50 to 60 feet wide, 20 to 30 feet deep. You had seven cars and a motorcycle. Ground just opened up because of Hurricane Ida. Highway 26 West shut down traffic. Well, completely, because you now have a giant sinkhole crater that swallowed all this stuff up. And look, you know, the hurricane, this is the hurricane, but it's also the fact that our infrastructure hasn't been rebuilt in decades and isn't prepared for the climate change and the storms that are coming. Even in a place like Mississippi, where they get hurricanes regularly, it's gonna get worse, which is why we need major, major investment. That's why I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's good to be with you as always.
So I'm looking at this giant hole, and the pictures are, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. They had to get a crane to pull people out of this giant sinkhole. And it's because we haven't invested in our infrastructure and we haven't done the things that we need to do to prepare us for what's coming.
Yeah, you're right about that. And obviously you're right to point to the hurricane as the precipitating event. But like with a lot of things, there's a backstory to this as well. And that backstory is two or threefold. Number one, our infrastructure is old. Bridges in particular, we have tens of thousands of bridges that are deficient because they were built to last for a set amount of time and we're well beyond that time span. Number two, the construction that was done wasn't done with resiliency in mind, the ability to withstand major events like this. I mean, you know, I know there are some localities, some states that have stricter codes for things like this because they're either in earthquake zones or more recently, you know, in the face of hurricanes. But by and large, that hasn't been a factor when constructing in the past. And then the third factor is obviously the fact that even though people talk about this all the time, you know, Washington has done not much to move the needle forward on any of these issues until very recently. And, you know, I remain hopeful. Be interested to see how you feel about infrastructure as well. But I'm optimistic that we can get something across the finish line before October the 1st that will allow a rebuilding of bridges, roads, other infrastructure, and to do it in a way where unfortunately we have to face reality, which is we're going to have more major events like this, and we need an infrastructure that's going to be resilient and able to withstand all of that as well.
No, absolutely, and it's something we need to be doing now. And I look at the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill that I don't think is sufficient. I think we need much more. In fact, the Society for Civil Engineers has come out and said we need $4.6 trillion in hard infrastructure stuff, and we need it now. And I don't think the $3.5 trillion plan is enough because we've neglected our infrastructure and our human infrastructure for decades. So this is just kind of a small catch-up. I mean, the numbers are staggering, but it's a small catch-up for years of neglect.
Yeah, this is a down payment. I mean, it gets us from failing grades or C minuses up to something that is a little more acceptable, but that is not great. And I think this is the thing, you know, I'm an American exceptionalist in some ways, in other ways, definitely not, but in some ways I am, where we should be leading the world in this. We should be showing the way how this is done. But when you look all around you with the physical infrastructure, most of the great examples of the 21st century are not in the United States, and we're instead playing catch up. So you're right. This is this infrastructure bill is kind of a down payment. And everybody, you know, in a couple of years will say, well, those guys just got their hands on a bunch of money. And Rick, you're absolutely right. It's not enough. I mean, that was like the first installment. But we do have a long, not only roads and bridges, on other forms of physical infrastructure, as you mentioned, like school buildings, waterworks, broadband, and the list goes on, in addition to ensuring that we have the social infrastructure in place so that people don't get whipsawed during catastrophic events or economic downturns as well.
No, absolutely. But here's the thing, and this is the thing that's concerning to me, is, you know, we're looking at all the shortages that we have in our supply chain. You look at all of the things that they're telling us we don't manufacture or can't manufacture. And I go, you are in this moment where we need massive investment. We need, you know, we need tons of steel and cement and you name it. We need stuff to build stuff. And yet we don't have the manufacturing capacity at this moment to do it. Now, that doesn't mean I don't believe we can't build it. But at this moment, we don't have it.
Right. Yeah, there's shortages not only of semiconductors, but of a lot of critical materials and other sorts of goods as well. And there are two fundamental reasons for that. One is that we've been in this crazy time, obviously. The second is that we lost a lot of that capacity. And when you're not making the stuff, you're not first in line. I mean, the home country, the home region, they're going to take care of themselves. And this is exactly what the government in Beijing has done with all the multinational companies that located there. It's like, wait. You're going to take care of us first, and then you can help the rest of the world. So if, for instance, you know, the majority of the world's semiconductors are made in China, or 70% of the lithium-ion batteries, that definitely creates a leverage problem. And I think this administration understands that, and they understand that in a way that has an urgency to it, is that we do have to build up this capacity in a hurry in the United States, so that we are not so that we're not at a point where we're over leveraged, so that we can mitigate some of this political risk, but also so that we can have a smooth running economy and supply chain for complex things like automobiles, which we do. You know, we build great automobiles when we have the parts. So if we make more of those parts in America, we're not going to have the same challenge.
No, I'll tell you, I wish we made more auto parts in the U.S. because the ones that we get from China are junk. I've got a friend who's a mechanic. He says, you know, half the parts I pull out of the box are no good out of the box, let alone you put them in and you go through five starters to get one that works. I'd like us to have some quality control and some pride in the work that gets done. It's just we're in this weird spot that we've allowed corporate America to go chase the cheapest labor, the most exploitable environmental conditions. And what it's done is it's created this, the consumer's screwed, working people are screwed, the country's screwed, and now we got to dig out of this huge mess. And what's coming out of Washington, I still don't believe is enough. And I know people are going to say, oh, we have all the, you want to spend all this money? Yeah, because we need to invest.
Yeah. And even then, Rick, it's still billions versus trillions. And the trillions being the money that the Chinese Communist Party and the government of Beijing puts up to prop up its own industries. Not only does it prop up its own industry through subsidies, it owns a bunch of them, too. So we're approaching nothing close to that. But if I'm confident that we don't need all of that money that China deploys, because I think we can do it more efficiently. But we do need a big boost, because otherwise, again, you know, we make something like 11 or 12% of the world's semiconductors right now. We make 1% of the world's solar panels. right now. We make 7% of the lithium-ion batteries in the world right now. And that is just not, that's completely inadequate, particularly when we want to grow those sectors of the economy. So it does take a plan. I mean, these companies, if they, you know, if they were going to have an act of altruism where they said, you know what, we're suddenly patriots, we're going to bring this stuff back to the United States, they would have done that a long time ago. No, it takes incentives, it takes policy, and it also takes a market. You know, Biden wants to build the market. You got to provide the right incentives, and you need the policy, like procurement, like buying American, to go along with that. And we need to lean in on that. And to me, this isn't a partisan issue. This is about making economically and from a national security point of view as well. So we ought to be able to get Democrats and Republicans behind policies like
on the national security front. I mean, our cyber infrastructure is so far behind and lacking. Our broadband access is pathetic, and I'm not thrilled with what they've done on that front in the infrastructure bill by just handing money over to corporate America and ensuring that my local community can't build out things that they need. There's so much that we should be doing that, sadly, lobbyists and the moneyed interests have figured out how to play this game. And this is where, you know, I'm hoping at some point we, as the working class of this country, wake up to the reality that we're divided at every opportunity, and that where we need to unite is on this stuff, because this is about national security. This is about the future of the country. And you look at, you go back to what happened today in Mississippi. You got roads that just are going to open up. I mean, is this going to be one of those moments where every day we're going to be worrying about which roads are opening up or bridges are collapsing or what's tragedies next because our infrastructure is failing us?
Yeah. Well, yes. And I think for the average citizen who may not think about semiconductors the way that auto executives do or others, certainly is going to be concerned about getting around town safely and having the ability to do that.
Right, especially if we're going to all EVs. I mean, if eventually we're going to go to electric vehicles.
Right.
You know, I had a caller, you know, recently go, hey, we can't go to electric vehicles because we're hyper-dependent on China for all of these chips and these wirings and all this stuff. We don't make any of this stuff. So what are we doing? Are we trading Middle East oil for Chinese electronics? We're still no better off. And I don't know that I disagree with them.
Right. Well, they're right about that, which is why for a long time, we have been advocating for Buy America provisions for the federal spending. Federal spending, you know, if you want a charging infrastructure and you want the federal government to pay for some of it, it's got to be made in America. Like, I think that's our point of view. Same with broadband. You want to build out broadband in your community. That fiber optic cable needs to be coming from the United States of America. And guess what? There are steelworkers in North Carolina who work for Corning who make this. So this is about well-paying jobs as well. And so you need that policy. You're right. If you just, if you're like California and you're just going to mandate electric vehicles, you don't care where they come from, you're going to give China a leg up because they are so far ahead in building out the supply chain. And unfortunately, they provide these massive subsidies to their companies that you need a procurement policy as well. It's like, yeah, consumers, we're going to give you an incentive if your electric car is made in the United States of America. And I think that's a really, really smart way to go. That's the way we're going to get back into the game.
Yep. No, and on every manufacturing front, but on the climate especially, because there's such an opportunity here to remake our economy in a way where people get good paying union jobs, where we're not trading for poverty wage jobs, that there's an opportunity for people to get ahead. But that we do make it here because we've got to address climate change. There, something has to happen. I don't know if you saw it today, but California evidently has closed all of their parks.
Right.
All of the national parks are closed because they're going too many fires. We just can't deal with it.
Yeah. So on the clean energy front, and we talked about electric vehicles and the catch up we have to do there. One thing that gives me some hope is that the big automakers in the United States have committed to EVs in the future, and we're going to make darn sure that they're manufactured in the United States. We're playing catch up on solar. You know, 1% of the world's solar panels are made in the United States. We need to boost that up. And with wind power generation as well. And for a long time, people have probably been seeing those big wind turbines go up either offshore or in some parts of the country. You know, I know they're, you know, in western Pennsylvania, you can see them. I was driving through the state of Indiana a couple weeks ago. There's miles and miles of them. Not a single one of those is made in the United States. And so you have to have a policy that says we're going to manufacture these in the United States. And guess what? It works. You know, just within the last, 4 or 5 weeks, we've seen some big announcement. Sparrows Point, which you know well in Baltimore, from Bethlehem Steel, they're going to be fabricating steel for offshore wind turbines there, creating hundreds of jobs. A major wind farm deployer just announced that they'll be manufacturing a substation to bring that, because you have to have a way to get that power to shore. They're going to be manufacturing the first one of those in the United States. So we're slowly but surely making progress. And Rick, to me, this is proof that if you have the policy, if you want to have the demand there, you know, you're saying this power has to be clean or these vehicles have to be electric. You also need the manufacturing policy to go along with it, the incentives for the manufacturers, and then also the rules that say these have to be made in the United States of America.
No, and this is where I think Joe Biden has done a really good job, and I'm thrilled that they're pushing in the right direction. Are there some things that I'm not thrilled with in that bipartisan bill? Yeah, there's a lot of stuff, but that's what you get. That's what you get. Absolutely. With bipartisanship.
Right. Yeah. It's. I mean, if you would have wrote the bill, if I would have wrote the bill, we'd do it completely different. I don't want to make the perfect be the obstacle of getting something done. And it's not even like we'll have to hold our noses on this, because there's a lot of good stuff. There just isn't enough.
Right.
There's a few stinkers in there, but nothing that is completely and totally outrageous like the trade-offs that Clinton and Gingrich made back in the 90s. There's nothing that approaches that. So let's get this over the finish line. Both of these important pieces of legislation, the physical infrastructure, and then the investments in our future, in our people, and in our clean energy, and in our manufacturing as well.
I'm right there with you. Scott, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff. Keep up the great work that you guys do there at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Thanks so much.
All right, Rick. Take care. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work yourself. Appreciate it.
You too, brother. Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, americanmanufacturing.org. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith. And this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1991. 3,500 buses rolled into Washington, D.C. They were loaded with protesters there to participate in Solidarity Day. The AFL-CIO organized the event to coincide with the Labor Day weekend. They issued a statement, Why We March, outlining labor's demands. The purpose of the day was to bring attention to the concerns of the nation's working people, especially over health care. Other reasons for the march included a call for more public works programs. Another major demand was the end to permanent replacement of striking workers by scabs. Bernie Dinkin, secretary treasurer of the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union in Philadelphia, explained, One of the main purposes for us going down is to let our friends know, our friends in the Democratic Party who are sitting on their laurels, that if they do not support anti-scab legislation, we will vote against them, no matter what they've done in the past. The most important aim of the event was to show worker strength and solidarity. A similar showing of solidarity had taken place in the nation's capital 10 years before. After President Reagan fired striking air traffic controllers, a September 1981 rally had drawn more than 250,000 people. The 1991 action brought out similar numbers. Despite the 95-degree weather, tens of thousands converged on the nation's capital. They came from across the nation and 30 countries. 100 buses and a specially chartered train made the trip from Philadelphia. Noticeable among the crowd were members of the United Steelworkers Union with their gold and blue shirts. 180 different labor, religious, and civil rights groups stood up on that day for the rights of working people. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.